From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in super smooth Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games.
In this episode, we talk with Nina Murata, level designer and encounter designer at High Moon Studios, to discuss, well, level design and encounter design. So if everyone's ready, let's start. Hi, Nina.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us at the end of your day.
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to be here.
One of the things that we were really excited about when we invited you on the show was level design is such a specific field within game design that I think a lot of game designers think they could do, they could pull off, but probably don't realize how little they actually know.
Right.
And so it is exciting for us because we've played the role, each of us, of you know, generalists and also been forced into specific roles. But I don't think any of us have any real experience in like level design as a field.
Yeah.
Even if we have done some level design. So we're really excited to have you here to offer that, I would say, more formal perspective. And so not to put too much pressure on you, but we're like all just very pumped.
Yes.
Because it's a topic we've talked about a lot on the show, but we haven't been able to focus on it with someone who, you know, knows the field. So I hope listeners are just as excited.
Yeah. So Nina, can you give listeners a bit of an introduction on yourself?
Yeah. So I'm Nina Murata. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and I am a associate level designer at High Moon Studios, which is, you know, part of the Activision publishing family.
Gotcha.
I work in Call of Duty, and I specialize in single-player encounter design, but I'm currently working on multiplayer encounter design.
Cool. Cool. That's exciting stuff. So I guess I'm curious what work goes into level design, I guess, and encounter design. Because I mean, I've done that myself, but like I'm not, you know, I don't get paid to do it. Someone didn't hire me specifically to do this thing. Like, so I'm curious, like, how would you describe your expertise, I suppose?
Yeah. Where are the boundaries?
And what's your day like? I'm also really curious, like, okay, so like if this is your specialty, what do you do in the morning and what do you do, you know, when you're interfacing with your colleagues?
Yeah.
Also, there's a cat. I just want to point out there's a cat in your room, which I didn't see at first. I don't know if the cat snuck in there before, like right after we started the call, but I just feel like everyone needs to know. Dale would be disappointed.
His name is Kelso.
Kelso?
Sweetheart.
Yeah. He's so cute. He's looking at his foot. Okay, I'm done.
Yeah, so level design, you know, I kind of describe it to my family that doesn't know anything about games, is that it's kind of like playing with blocks or Legos as an adult, where you're kind of placing down these big geo brushes and you're making the world, you're making the map. It also includes encounter design, which includes placing and scripting AIs, AI encounters, loot pickups, and just anything general that the player is meant to interact with will mostly end up doing that. My limit is, at High Moon, we have this specialized type of gameplay engineer called tech designer, where they basically make all of the mechanics that we need. Recently, I was asking, you know, could we put a dumbwaiter in this level? And I asked one of our tech designers, like, can we steal your elevator and make it a dumbwaiter? So that's kind of what tech designers do. I kind of take the mechanics and things they make, put it into the game while also building the geo and the map around it.
So when you start that process, are you given kind of a mandate or a log line from another department, or maybe a theme or some constraint, like it should be to take this amount of time or something? Or are you do you start like by prototyping different layouts and then move forward from there?
Yeah. So at High Moon, we're very like laid back about how we design things. I mostly will get like a design brief from both my design managers and also the other studios like Treyarch or Raven or IW, because we support them as a support studio. So ultimately the creative decisions come from them and Activision shareholders, but it basically comes down to I get a PowerPoint that's like, hey, we want to make a level that's set in a market, and you know, we kind of have to work with that, and we get some input from narrative design where they say, hey, in this market you're going to meet one of the main characters, and you kind of want to set up this, you know, dark mysterious atmosphere and stuff. And so I basically just start with researching. if the level itself is set in like a real world setting, I'll go in Google Maps and start looking at that, driving around. I start paper prototyping. Okay. I sometimes do it with grid paper physically. A lot of times I've moved into using just Photoshop to just literally draw rectangles, put labels on it, and then I'll run those past my manager for the first couple iterations. And then once we're at a good point, I'll move into the editor and stop blocking that out. Mm-hmm. And it pretty much was just iteration from there. Once we're really happy with the geo, it becomes placing the encounters and the AI and scripting them. And then from there, it's kind of iterating on both at the same time until we're happy with it.
Got it. For the layperson, such as myself, what is a geo?
So geo is basically our way of talking about brushes, okay. Like the Unity, or not Unity, but Unreal brushes, those block brushes that you just put down. It's walls, it's floors, it can even be a fountain if you model it really well, but they're simple cube polygonal shapes that just help us lay out our level without getting into art, because art kind of wants to do things on their own.
Right. So,
yeah. I had been thinking of it as geometry. I don't know if that works or not, but
I was thinking of geography.
Wow. Okay. We're all over the place.
It comes from maybe one of those.
Yeah.
I'm glad I asked.
Me too.
Yeah.
So when you're thinking about encounter design in the levels you create, how it seems a little chicken and egg to me. Presumably, you like you say, it's a little bit laid back, so maybe it's not always the same each time. But do you generally kind of think of those in tandem, or is it really just about laying out the space first and then using that as your constraint to design the encounters?
I think it's important to design with your encounter in mind. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of working on them both in tandem because, you know, a level is just an empty world until you actually put encounters in it. So they both have to lean into each other. The level has to direct the player into encounters, and the encounters have to fill up the geo, the world, with stuff to do.
Right,
so they definitely are things that you have to do together and take into consideration every step of the way. You can't just, oh, look at this beautiful building I made, and oh, I'm just going to put AI wherever I feel like it.
Yeah.
That doesn't work.
Right. They'll influence each other. And so they have to be kind of developed together. That makes a lot of sense. It also makes a lot of sense why, you know, you don't want it, you want it to be laid out simply and not throw in a bunch of art or greebles or whatever, because it just because you've designed the layout of it doesn't mean it's going to stay that way.
Right. It's not worth putting in all the effort of, you know, putting in all this beautiful artwork if the level isn't conducive, if the player doesn't enjoy playing it, if playtests fail. All that artwork was for no reason.
Mm-hmm. Oh, playtests. You probably playtest a ton. All of your levels.
Yes.
Yeah. That's awesome.
That's the dream.
Yeah. to have people playtesting your game and like dedicated for that, that's really nice. Haven't gotten to that point in my career yet. So, that's wonderful.
When does that process start?
Yeah.
Like right away before it even works? Or do you have like a threshold you meet before you start putting in front of yourself and then other folks?
I pretty much just start playtesting as soon as I can. Like the first iteration in the engine, I'm going to compile it and run it and just walk around to get a feel for it. I typically won't pull someone in until I feel like I'm ready to move on to the next step, or I feel like I'm at a place where I'm feeling a little stagnant. I don't know what needs to change, but something has to. It also depends on fully like our dev pipeline, which has changed quite a bit in the last month or so. So it's kind of up in the air, but for the most part, you know, you want to keep people involved while you're working on it too. You can't just trust your own judgment, because everybody has their own design philosophies and their own play styles. And you kind of want to lean into all the different ways that a player could play it.
So when you're talking about playtesting, you're not necessarily just talking about, you know, end users that you might have access to. You're also making sure that your colleagues and everybody's playtesting it while you're working on it.
Yep, totally. I will even pull in, we have a new HR rep who she's never played video games really. And she's like, I want to play with you guys sometimes. So I invited her to some of our vendor builds. I'm like, look, join us. Like, we need as many opinions as we can get about how the game flows and how it works, because that's the only way we can improve is by listening to feedback.
For sure. For sure. Playtest people.
We keep trying to hammer that in, and I don't know if people are listening to it yet.
I'm not sure if we've mentioned it enough on the show before.
Yeah, we should probably do more of that. So I wanted to ask about encounter design. You said that you script the AI. I know you're working on Call of Duty. So I imagine, I guess what I'm imagining is happening, and please correct me because I'm sure I'm wrong, is you script when the enemies will come into the level at certain points in the game, and also like how they disperse themselves within the level, or is there more to it than
yep.
that? Okay.
There's a little bit more to it, but for a lot of single player scripting, it is just that it's working with info volumes and nodes and sending AI once the player hits a certain flag or a trigger, sending AI to certain volumes, to certain nodes. But it also, I've been working on ambient encounters lately in multiplayer, which includes just scripting the day-to-day stuff. You know, two soldiers sitting around a fire or a guy patrolling a building. You know, we put the patrol routes down. We set him to aggro at a certain point. We set when he spawns, when he despawns, when the body cleanup runs on him, if reinforcements spawn behind him. It's kind of all over, but a lot of it is based on what project that we're working on.
Sure.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that initially, because initially just thinking about it, like that, what you were describing, Stephen, totally came to mind. But what you were talking about too is totally a part of the experience as well. Like what happens after the player has vanquished somebody, what happens to that, you know, that polygon body on the ground,
right.
Like it has to be cleaned up, and that's part of the experience too. How long is it supposed to be there? And there are lots of considerations that you got to take into account. What the player is going to, you know, how long is the player going to need the information that's represented by that character being on the ground?
Right.
That kind of stuff is also part of the encounter. That's pretty cool. I hadn't really thought about that before.
Yeah, it's definitely a hard area to work in, because you want to make sure that you're cleaning up bodies and loot as quickly as you can to optimize performance, but you also want to keep it for design and narrative purposes. So it becomes a balancing act, really, between what you show the player and how that affects their player experience just based on performance and optimization alone.
That's kind of eye-opening to hear how much of your work involves performance optimization, or, you know, keeping it in mind at least, because it seems like, oh, that must be the domain of another department, but it kind of can't be. Everyone has to think about it, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everybody knows, or at least is aware of some of our performance boundaries. Mm-hmm. We can only have a certain number of AI, a certain number of arguments, a certain number of integers and stuff. Like, so while I don't really touch on that for the most part, it can come up if I don't optimize an encounter well. Let's say I have, instead of using an info volume to send AI to a volume, I'm sending them to individual nodes. Well, that's going to be taking up a lot of data space. And when it comes down to ship time, we're going to look and go, oh my gosh, we have too much going on. We can't actually ship it because we're limited. So we do have to think about optimizing and kind of making things as modular as we can, even with being a level designer.
Yeah, because it's not just one level. There is a lot going on. Yeah, exactly. So how do you interface with your colleagues to make sure that you're hitting the right balance? Like, what questions are you asking from the people that you're working with to make sure you got that sweet spot?
A lot of it is just asking, hey, how do you feel about this? Like, can you build it, and what do you feel? And a lot of it is, you know, I think the team composition here is off, or I feel, you know, it's maybe too saturated with AI, dial it back a little bit. And we thankfully have some standards for the project that we're working on right now, where our ambient encounters are only 1 to 3 people spawning in a certain POI on the map. The point of interest, but sometimes with single player you don't really get those kind of limitations, so you kind of go a little hog wild, and then you go, okay, wait, we need to scale it back, because there's like 7,000 like cannon fodder enemies and then the one boss, and you kind of lose the boss in that. So it really comes down to design sense and game feel.
Yeah, you're relying on the, you know, the design sense, like you said, of the people that you're working with, and also the experience of all the people kind of collectively. That totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. I really do like that when that's an answer, because I think it's just like, it just makes the whole design process like so much more human.
I know, that's so cool.
I know, it's cool. It's cool.
Dang it, I'm excited for you.
I'm excited that you're excited, that she's excited. Yeah.
So how many levels do you say you would, you yourself manage throughout the a game? I guess I'll call it, they're so big, so I don't know.
Yeah. So I've only been at the studio for less than a year now, but I was leading a part of a level. It was a level that was split into four smaller kind of sub-levels. Mm-hmm. I was managing one of those entirely, but unfortunately we were taken off the project for now to go work on another project with Treyarch in multiplayer.
Okay.
So I'm kind of right now leading the charge on the ambient encounters in half of that map, which is, I think, 13 POIs. So I do get my hands in everything. And I think that's one of the biggest benefits of working at a COD support studio, is that we get to touch every single COD game that comes out. We work on Warzone, we work on Modern Warfare, we work on Black Ops, we work on Zombies. We really get our hands into all these different variations of design and design philosophy.
That's
which is really,
fascinating.
Really cool.
I guess I had always gotten the impression that most of the in big studios, AAA studios, most of the employees work on like real specific aspects of the game, and they don't, other than like, you know, their managers making sure that everything combines well, they don't really get to spread out and explore other aspects of the game. So it's really interesting for me to hear that that is not the case. At least where you're working now, that's not the case. That's cool.
Yeah, it's really cool because even right now our project is multiplayer, but we just got word from Activision Publishing that we're going to be allowed as a studio to lead to campaign levels of it. Nice. So we get to go back to single player in a little bit just to work on that. And again, you just kind of get to bounce around and touch everything. And I think that is so much fun.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of that is helped by the fact that you are a support studio. So you have to be flexible to the needs of the project and maybe a little bit more nimble than the originating studio needs to be. Would you say that's right, or am I off on that?
No, I would say you're 100% right on that. I think I interviewed with Infinity Ward, and at the same time that I was interviewing with High Moon, ironically, but I ultimately chose High Moon because I got a more varied experience with the COD franchise. Yeah. And it is very true that, you know, Infinity Ward focuses on Modern Warfare, Treyarch focuses on Zombies, Raven focuses on Black Ops, Sledgehammer focuses on the World War II, the historical games. While our support studios, Demonware, Beenox, Toys for Bob, High Moon, we get to touch all of it. We touch Warzone. We touch Zombies, Modern Warfare. Vanguard we worked on. I mean, we've literally gotten to work on every single thing. And that, you wouldn't get that at one of the big three studios, Treyarch, Raven, or IW.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It sounds so obviously attractive to work with on a support studio. Maybe it doesn't have the prestige of the first logo up when you boot it up, but being able to touch it, especially as an individual contributor, is probably really, really rewarding compared to an individual contributor at Treyarch or at Sledgehammer.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like at High Moon, I'm afforded more of an option to take control of a section of the game and be able to point to it when it ships and go, I made that.
Yeah.
While that's not necessarily the case at one of the big three studios.
Just to be able to do that. I keep fanboying. I'm sorry.
How did you get into level design and encounter design, like as a career path? What brought you to this place?
So I got my degree in computer design, animation, and game design from Kent State University. Mm. And one of my professors was Chris Totten at the time. And
that guy.
We interviewed him too.
We had him on the show.
He put on a talk by Matt Potifant Anderson at IO Interactive about the level design of Hitman and how they stratified each level into like low alerts, medium alerts, and like high alerts, and how it was socially stratified and lead into both psychology and sociology. Like, for example, you know, you can't have a gun out in a church on the Sapienza level in Hitman because that would be against social mores. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was fascinating. I thought this is the coolest thing because it's taking the things we look at in social sciences. I was originally an anthropology major. So we're taking these things where we're looking at how society is structured, how we interact, how we're expected to act in certain behaviors, and it's applying it to the game. It's making the mechanics. I mean, I remember telling Chris, I mean, level design isn't just maps. It's not just making buildings and maps all day. It's literally making the majority of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And even in subtle ways, if you're just saying, hey, look, you're in a bank, you can't pull out a gun. It's this discipline that touches everything, and Chris really fostered my interest in it, would send me GDC talks all the time, and I actually got to talk to Matt Potifant Anderson on Twitter, so like she was kind of one of my mentors along with Chris the whole time, and I just kind of started building my own levels. I was working on paper prototypes a lot. I made a lot of Hitman-esque Deus Ex kind of styled levels because I absolutely love social stealth games.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Then I started working in Unreal and making levels and Unity. It was just something I just kind of fell naturally into. I grew up, you know, I was always playing The Sims and I was always building houses. And at one point I was the leading residential lot creator on The Sims 2 Exchange when I was like 9.
That's awesome.
And so like it's always been something I've loved. If a game gives me a chance to build a world, like Fallout 4's crafting systems, or you know, I had this architecture software as a kid that I would just build houses in because I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was a game. It was not a game. It was like professional software, but still, like I've just always building worlds, and so it came very naturally to me where I'm like, yes, this is what I want to do. This is the coolest thing on the planet.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Like you basically started doing it when you were a kid, and then you thought you didn't think about it as like a career, and then you found your way to it. It does kind of sound like it was meant to be.
Yeah, it was. I changed my major about 4 times. I ended up joining the military, getting injured in the military and leaving it. And, you know, I was at this very, very low point in my life, and my advisor asked me, she's like, well, what do you actually want to do? I'm like, I want to make games. I really just want to make games. And mm-hmm. she brought up that, hey, we have this major that's at a satellite campus that it's kind of hard to get into it. And the classes aren't really offered very often on the main campus, but like it is an option. And I switched into that day. Like there was no hesitation. So,
awesome.
And it's like, I look back and I've really just been all about world building. I'd be playing with Lego sets as a kid. I was always building houses and mm-hmm. even playing with blocks and Lincoln Logs. Like it kind of seems like it was my destiny in a weird way.
Yeah, that's cool. But it also sounds like you had like some supportive people around you as well, you know? Like I could have totally imagined an advisor being like, yeah, but really, you know,
yeah.
I'm glad that that person didn't do that and actually encourage you to like chase it. That's really cool.
Yeah. Our staff for my major program are the kindest, sweetest people that are so, so, so supportive. Like I couldn't have done any of it without them.
That's awesome.
You know, I think thinking about your story about like where you started and like playing with Legos as a kid, I'm like, well, that is a lot of people's experience. But I think you are different in that what I'm hearing through the whole tale of it is like you're describing space as story. It's not just space. And hearing in it, that's part of the appeal to you and part of how you the lens through you see it. So talk a little bit about that as you're putting together a layout or designing encounters or pacing things out. How to, and I don't necessarily mean like the narrative of the single player campaign, but just the movement through a level. And how do you think about that as you design? And how a novelist, do you start at the beginning or do you start at the end or do you start in the middle? I guess I'm just asking that same sort of question about the story of the space you're making.
Yeah. So I think a level can really be thought of as, I kind of think of it more as a movie or a show. You know, you kind of, you know, I was working on a museum level once and it was kind of like you had this, you start off in this gorgeous courtyard. And, you know, it's very calm. There's nothing going on. There's no enemy AI. There's nothing really to alarm you. And you go into the museum and it's this big, beautiful lobby. And you see off in the corner, there's a vent that you can access and get into. And there's also a glass wall that, you know, you have a prompt that you can shatter it and stuff. So you kind of start to get the little story elements very subtly. And you would leave the lobby either through going through the vent or through the window or through the main doors, which required kind of a loud way of accessing it because they were locked. But, you know, but you kind of you left that and you ended up in this great big hall full of, you know, priceless artifacts and stuff. And there's enemies patrolling everywhere. And further down the hall, you could see this big beautiful window, and in there was the main target, the boss of the level. And it's kind of, I kind of think of it as kind of like the basic three act story structure when I think of a level, because you want to introduce your character to what they're getting themselves into. You want to introduce them to the map. You also want to give them little breadcrumbs of, hey, there's something I can do here. There's a story here. And then you kind of want to have the big exposition, the big shootout, the big, you know, rescue the hostages thing, and then kind of a conclusion at the end where you leave it, whether that's through the main door or by taking out the target itself. Like, it has a very structured story-like cadence to it.
It does. Which... You know, I've never really thought about it that way, but it totally does, right? The first thing you do when you're going into this virtual space is you're trying to just get your bearings. You have an idea of what you're trying to accomplish, but you don't know how you're going to accomplish it. And as you make sense, then you get to kind of like phase two, which is like you start doing the thing, and then you do the thing, and then you got to get out.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that first thing you described, like that vent in the corner that catches the player's attention, that's like the inciting incident, right? That's where you go from observer to participant.
Yeah.
Right? That's an interesting moment that I hadn't really considered as a way to judge whether a level is successful or not, but it seems like a pretty good rule of thumb. Like, to look for that moment.
Yeah.
Because I would bet that's you'd find it in the most successful levels.
Like, I'm going to think about levels in a totally different way now. When I'm, like, just playing games, I've never really thought about the level design, like, for in that way. I'm going to definitely think, like, okay, gatto rubato. I'm opening the room. I'm walking in the room. Okay. Shooting the, you know.
Yeah.
What would this be? How would Nina describe this?
Yeah.
It is kind of fascinating when, you know, you start making games, it's very difficult for myself to like turn off my game dev brain when I'm playing games now. So like, I'll just be like, oh, that's an interesting design choice they made there. Or, oh, I can see why that bug happened or something.
I know why that vent's there. I know what that vent's trying to say.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a genre savviness that a lot of us develop as moviegoers.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that we don't appreciate, like, a trope comes up and you kind of know where they're going.
Yeah.
But you can still kind of enjoy it.
Right.
And there's that fine line you have to, you know, as a creator, you have to decide like how much to let the viewer or participant use their own knowledge to help navigate this thing versus how much am I there to surprise and challenge them. And it feels very, sounds like it's the same problems. Getting a level, you know, you don't want someone coming in and not knowing how doors work in this game,
right?
And make that the challenge when to get to that inciting incident, you have to go through a door. But you also don't want it to be like every game they've ever played before. That balance has got to be, and also the players' tastes too. Some do want it to feel exactly like the last thing they played, and you want to make sure that those people aren't, you know, scared away, but the people who are, you know, ready for a new thing. You have to make sure there's something there for them too. Mm-hmm. So it's, especially for Call of Duty, you have to design for such a wide audience of people who are interested in very different things.
Yeah.
And so the analogies to movie making, they more and more keep popping up in my head.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said about tropes in video games too. I think that, you know, you can lean into these things that people know, like, you know, red barrels explode.
Right.
That's been a thing since oh my gosh, like Half-Life, I think was the first time I encountered that. And that's still something we use today. And I think that you can lean into these kind of expectations that players have to really create a good level without making it too predictable. I think the best level design is level design that you don't think about.
Yeah.
Right. Because if you start to get frustrated in a level, you're thinking, but why is this designed this way? This is horrible. I'm lost. Where am I going? What am I doing? A good level will tell you and show you without, you know, holding your hand the whole time.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You might feel challenged, but you're challenged by, you feel challenged in a way that's still immersive rather than challenged in a way that takes you out of the immersion.
Totally.
Okay.
NiceGames.club/feedback. Talked about it on the show several times before, but I want y'all to hear it again. NiceGames.club/feedback. Please give us feedback. We love feedback.
Especially
He's laughing,
Steven.
But this is not a joking matter.
Yes. Yeah, I nervously laugh all the time. I'm sorry.
Why are you nervous?
I don't know.
Because you're worried people will give us feedback?
It's really important, I think.
It's very important. And as a result, I'm scared that people won't give us feedback, and it makes me laugh.
You know, people do give us feedback, though.
Yeah, they do. They do. They do give us feedback. One thing that somebody told us is that more Star Trek references are always good.
Good feedback.
Pound it, Mark. Pound it.
Okay, well, fine. If you want to give us more feedback, like more Star Trek references, please go to nicegames.club/feedback and let us know. I want to hear more about encounter design. And specifically, like, how the encounters help progress that story, that narrative that you're trying to get across to the player.
So the encounters can actually, like, really lean into showing the player the story by, you know, team composition is one of them that I really like using. You know, if you know you're going into a CQC kind of situation, you know, so you're going to have someone with a shotgun or short range arms. You're also going to have different levels of AI. So, you know, you might have street police officers, then you'll have paramilitary or cartel, then you'll have military, and then you'll have like the juggernaut kind of bosses. So you kind of tell the player, you know, this is an area that you're relatively safe in because there's low level enemies here. And then it gets higher and higher and higher. And it tells the player, I'm reaching a conclusion. I'm reaching a spot where the story is going to advance.
Yeah.
Just by AI composition alone, it can really help. And it also helps with placement too. You know, something I always do whenever I'm lost in a game is, okay, where's the next enemy?
Right.
Because
yes.
The enemies are like little breadcrumbs and they're telling you, hey, go this way. So that is still something we lean into with encounter design, is that we kind of need to still tell players where to go occasionally, and enemies are a great way to do it. You know, it's against, you know, common sense, but you kind of want to run towards the people shooting you in video games. So,
yeah.
Because it leads you to the next thing, thing you're supposed to go to. It does make sense. And in what you're describing to me reminds me of like a basic interest curve. Like your interest will go, I'm making a drawing in the air. People can't see this.
It's a podcast.
Yes.
audio medium.
But the interest curve, the base interest curve, you know, where things become more interesting as you progress further, partly because like the player has a better understanding of things and can handle more stuff, but also to hold their attention more up to the climax. So that makes a lot of sense. And I guess I hadn't really thought about it in that way, but yeah, like, you know, fighting big juggernauts with a ton of armor and stuff, and you need to, you know, shoot them a lot in order to take them down, and still having to deal with all these other enemies really adds intensity to an encounter in a way that's really cool.
When you were describing like the different types of enemies,
yeah,
when you're working on a project that has those things all figured out, then you know the language of the game as well as the player will eventually learn it. But I imagine there are scenarios where that stuff isn't finalized yet. In which case, how do you sort of design for that feeling, even though the parts may change along the way, like that iterative process that happens outside your control?
So a lot of times we'll use placeholders. because of the way that Call of Duty is set up, you know, a lot of people seem to think that you can just copy and paste an AI from one con game to the other, and that's not at all how it works. Like, our games are not very interchangeable when it comes to our assets. So we'll typically just cobble together a project standard in the time being and be like, look, use this particular enemy asset to stand in for juggernauts or for tier three enemy types. Although sometimes that can be quite difficult because you're not necessarily getting the same feel or the same amount of damage as you would want to get out of a juggernaut or you know, a certain weapon. But it's all prototype for the most part. Like, games are always going to be ugly for like 90% of their development. You just kind of have to like internally be like, okay, but imagine once we get the AI that we need, like, this will work out.
It must be a challenge to like know that there's mechanics you want to exploit, but you can't fully realize them right now. Especially when, you know, when you that example you gave earlier about requests to get new mechanics or variations on mechanics. Do you find that you have to sort of decide, this is an area where I just need to resign myself to the imperfection until it rolls along, or it's risen to the point where I need to actually go and make sure that I get something from somebody else to make this work? How do you make that decision?
So throughout the process, it's kind of like there are certain areas that will be both at the same time, where it's kind of like, okay, I need this, but I'm okay with it being a little janky right now. Typically, it's kind of like once we reach a certain point, you know, certain milestones, certain goals for the team and for the project, where it's like, okay, we're moving out of prototype, we're moving into green light. You know, this is going to be seen by corporate. We need to make this a little cleaner. We can't use the hacks. That's when I would typically go, okay, I need you to make this mechanic and get it working. And, you know, for the most part, High Moon is very, very accommodating for those kind of demands. Typically, designers don't really get to make that many demands of engineers, but our studio does do a lot of work for our designers. And if I say, hey, look, I need a stealth mechanic or a disguise mechanic, there we will be able to get a cobbled together version within a week at the most, and then a clean version within a couple weeks after that. So it's just kind of learning to work with what you have and then making it a bit better as you go along.
That totally makes sense.
That reminds me of my job a lot. I'm the only programmer at where I work at Future Club. And so, like, designers and artists will sometimes ask me for tools.
And you'd be like, no.
No, I'm never like, no. That's probably a problem. I'll be like, this will be a lot of work, but I'll try. Yeah. Maybe I should say no more often. I don't know. But that's cool to hear that, like, you know, you both work in tandem in that way. You're making demands, quote unquote, on programmers per se, but it's not like they have the, you know, the ability to be like, this is too difficult. But also, I don't think you're like actively trying to push them to work themselves to death or anything like that. So
yeah,
I can hear that
course.
In your voice. So yeah, that's cool.
We work very well together, and I think that studio composition and also like just studio policies when it comes to just being nice to each other and teamwork is a huge proponent of that, because I wouldn't get through my workday without my two tech designers who are like my best friends. They started a week before I did, and they helped me with all my onboarding stuff. So we really foster this family feel here, which can sometimes be a red flag with studios when they say, oh, we're a family and you don't get any time off. But no, that's definitely not the case with High Moon. We are straight up a family. If I forget how to print lines in the engine, they're not going to say, hey, you're an idiot, you're bad at your job. They're just, oh yeah, here you go. Like, it's very much so a great place for me to grow and learn, and it's somewhere I want to stay as long as possible.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that is helped by the fact that you are flexible. You get to touch all around, and so everyone naturally knows a little bit about what everyone else does.
Right.
So there's more empathy, perhaps.
That's really interesting. Like, I've heard of manufacturing facilities doing that kind of thing. And partly, like I actually worked in a manufacturing facility for a couple of months while I was between careers, and it was
building tanks.
Sure.
It was seems like a you kind of thing.
Super explosions. Not that. It was about as far as you can get from explosions. Mm-hmm. It was like a food processing facility.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But and there were lots of different roles, right? And one of the things they wanted everyone to do was they'd rotate you every like half an hour, 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason they did that is because of like repetitive stress injury. And no matter what you're doing in game design, it's right here on a computer.
Right.
Right. So that's not going to be much. It's not going to really make much of a difference.
Yeah, you're going to get it either way.
You're going to get it no matter what. But it also had a really great effect in that it did give everyone on that was working on this floor, all like 45, 50 people at a time, experience in all the different spots along this line. So they understood that if you didn't put the toast in right, then it would screw that thing up down the line. And you might be there in 3 hours. So like, and everyone will have to be there longer, you know? Yeah. So like, it did really, I think that approach can be really helpful. I'm not sure how much that specifically translates to like the production pipeline on a AAA game. But when it comes to the support studio relationship to the game content that you were talking about, Nina, I can see a connection for sure. Mm. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that our ability to touch and see kind of everything is one of our strongest suits when it comes to, hey, we know, you know, this is going to cause a problem for art or for lighting down the road. We need to find a solution right now, fix up our design work, fix up our tech design work, and make it easier for them. I think that's something very unique, and it's not what I expected out of a AAA studio. I figured I would work very siloed, very much so. I make issues and just send them off and someone else fixes them. But no, we kind of all learn to work together. Our production and our IT, as well as our tech designers, are all there to support us for technical issues and software issues, even though it's not technically anybody outside of IT's job. But mm-hmm. production mm-hmm. and tech designers are there to kind of pick up where IT might not be able to, because they're a little, there's only four for a 200 person studio, so it's a lot of work for them. So
yeah,
it's, and you know, even I went through onboarding a week before one of my level design coworkers, and I ended up writing my own onboarding documents for him. Like, this is what helped me. These are the shortcuts that I know. These are the bugs I ran into. This is how to fix it and stuff. Mm-hmm. And High Moon really fosters that culture of mm-hmm. just lend a hand.
It's interesting that you tell that story, because you know you've praised the people you work with, but you're describing not just being a part of that collaborative supportive community, but contributing to that directly as a matter of course. And I think it helps that you're inspired to do it, but it also requires you to do it. So like, good on you for making sure that that is part of the culture there.
Yeah.
I think everybody, like, that's something that I think people get frustrated by, like, oh, my workplace is, you know, the culture is really rough there. And it's like, well, you are part of that.
Yeah.
And so it's always helpful to examine that and make sure that you know that you're doing as much as you can and no more to contribute to that. So it's very interesting that you were telling that, like, right off the bat, you were like, this seems like a place that supports everybody, so I guess I should be doing that.
Yeah, the culture's strong enough that you felt like comfortable pitching in on week two or whatever.
Yeah. And I've only been here for less than a year, and our beloved, one of our animators, left, and she was in charge of the Women's Network and the DE&I Network, the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Network. And she's like, mm-hmm. look, you're the only one who shows up to everything. Do you want to take over it? And I did. It's very intimidating being the representative for my studio for the greater ABK employee networks. But it is so fulfilling, because that's what we need to do. We need mm-hmm. someone to step in, and I did it. And it's because High Moon has fostered such a great culture of just lending a hand, helping out where you need to, that I was able to do that. Because if it was any other studio, I'd probably be like, absolutely not. I'm terrified. I like cannot do that. Sorry. But I went from, within 6 months of being here, I having one-on-one meetings with our studio head talking about DE&I issues and women's network initiatives and stuff. And it's our culture that really, really helps foster these conversations.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
That's like a whole separate interview you might have to have you back on to talk about. Although I don't think we're quite done with this one.
Yeah. Well, I love when we have someone on like, this is going to be great. And then like, you know, halfway through you drop but I'm also really interesting in this other way.
Well, can you stay on for another 5 hours? Actually, I wanted to ask you about something that came up just a couple minutes ago. We were talking about the way that having a support studio approach to different work might influence the culture and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
I want to kind of pivot back to the level design and encounter design question. And I'm curious to hear you talk about how being able to work on lots of different projects and different parts of this franchise influences your approach to level design and encounter design. Right, because there's some spiritual similarities between the different projects that you're probably working on, but on the other hand, they're like really critical differences as well. Otherwise, they wouldn't be different games.
Right.
So, like, what do you think about that when you're switching your brain from one project to the next? How do you approach that?
So I was actually super super lucky to be hired when we were starting work on a open world kind of non-linear project. Mm-hmm. So I definitely leaned into that because that's my favorite type of game. It's nonlinear gameplay. I love Deus Ex. I love Hitman. I love all these games that let me explore the world and use the world to my advantage. And so I got to really open my mindset to both the Call of Duty franchise, because I was completely new to it when I started here. I had maybe played Black Ops for like 5 minutes and hated it, so I was playing multiplayer with my brother and he just kept spawn killing me, and I'm like, you know what, this isn't fun, I'm going back to playing The Sims.
So it's more like, but you hated your brother in that moment.
yeah
fair.
But like I really got to explore the Call of Duty franchise, and you know, we talk about a lot the Call of Duty formula of linear gameplays, and I got to explore the franchise in a completely new light as an open world project. And we've shifted more from a single player project to a multiplayer project, which brought on its own unique challenges that you have to think about. You know, the game is perpetual. Mm-hmm. What brings players back? What is the loop here? Why are they playing it? They're not just playing it for a linear narrative. They're playing it to grind, to earn certain things, to find certain things. I think like there is significant overlap between every COD title, because it wouldn't be COD without that. But I think that there's also a lot of freedom and elasticity in the way that you design for them both, for all of it.
Yeah, it sounds like a really fun challenge from a designer's perspective, to keep the stuff that needs to be the same while also changing the things that need to be different. That's like a fascinating, I mean, it's one of those great design brain problems where you have to find, again, the right level of balance.
Yeah, there's so many stakeholders, including players, that like are going to that evaluate the work that you do. And so it needs to, there's expectations that are so high to be the same in some ways and different in other ways. And depending on the person you're asking, those things might not always be the same. But also to throw in there your own creative perspective. And to put that in there and make sure that it doesn't overwhelm, but also isn't overwhelmed by. So it's a I think it's a bigger challenge than other franchises. I can't just hearing you describe all that stuff. It's having to keep that all in your head. It must be rewarding when it's going well, because it's such a successful high wire act, right?
Yeah, totally. You know, there'll be times when we're in brainstorming sessions, I'm like, oh, this would be a great idea. And they're like, yeah, our players will absolutely hate that.
Like, oh, no.
Okay, well, I thought it was a good idea, but okay, we'll scrap that. But, you know, High Moon just released Fortune's Keep on Warzone. And I'm not on the Warzone team, but I'm very close with a lot of people on the Warzone team. And it is getting so much praise. And It feels so good to just read these things, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not often that you get people being excruciatingly nice about COD games.
Yeah.
And, you know, every single person I've talked to has been like, Fortune's Keep is the best. I'm having a blast with you guys, knocked out of the park. And like, it feels so rewarding, even not being on the team, that we have the talent and the studio ability to create new experiences in COD and still manage to please, you know, the long-term franchise fans.
Yeah, that is really cool.
You mentioned earlier about working with the different departments, and that's a big part, I think, of the lessons learned for listeners today. But what we haven't touched on yet is the visual design, the art team.
Yeah.
And we talked initially about how you basically have to, you know, you have to kind of leave them for later, but they do eventually show up and start adding things, right? And but at the same time, because you're laying out these layouts, you are also part of the visual art team in a way. And when it comes to like film visuals, I'm a very big proponent of composition, like where things exist next on the frame. And that's so true in a layout for a level. And you walk through a doorway, what do you see on the left? What do you see on the right? How much of the thing on the left do you see? And that is something that visual artists are really attuned to and they contribute to, but you're the first person who touches that part of it. So how's that relationship between the art team? Because logistically, I would guess it's the most separated from the other teams just by necessity. But how much are you able to work with them back and forth? And how much inspiration do you get from them to put into your layouts? Or is there just not enough time for that level of collaboration?
So we're actually lucky that we're moving away from, you know, the Call of Duty every year model, mm-hmm. where we're going to start having a bit more time between title releases. So we do get a lot more time, and Art has produced vignettes for us. The courtyard vignette that I mentioned earlier for the museum level, mm-hmm. was actually straight up just completely made by Art, and I based my design of the museum around the Art vignette. And you know, we have a lot of conversations back and forth with Art. If I say, hey, look, this pillar has to be here for composition purposes, Art will mostly work with us on that. But there are some times where I'm like, hey, you know, I really imagined this wall being kind of brick, kind of old. And they're like, no, you don't know anything about it. Let us handle it. And that's totally valid because I'm not an artist. So like, I'll take their opinion on it. But no, we have a great working relationship with Art. There are times that there'll be like an X model or something with non-manifold geometry that will just completely break the game. And, you know, I go crying to the artists and animators. I'm like, please help me fix it. And they will always, always help out with design. And they're always very willing to listen to our ideas. We're always very willing to listen to their ideas. It's mm-hmm. it's not the typical antagonistic relationship that a lot of people think exists between design and art. It really goes hand in hand.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my pessimism on that was really just about logistics, but it's really exciting to hear that you're able to get a piece of an asset from Art, and then that can inspire you in your layouts. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we had a question on here that we've been circling the whole hour, which is, you know, what inspires you? What gets you going? And we've heard examples of it coming from all sorts of different places,
right?
Not just one place. It's not a rote production, you know, process each time. Mm-hmm. And that's like electric. Mm. I love that.
Yeah, there's space for you to play as a designer, like, and there's space for you to discover as a designer. Even though you're plugged into all these other groups, they also get the same kind of freedom because you guys have enough space in terms of time and culture to be able to talk to each other, mm-hmm. like, and iterate with your designs and ideas off of one another. That's how you want it to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good lesson for folks who are, you know, listening, who work in any field, is like, seek out that relationship with other departments or you know, you're on any team with another person that has different disciplines than you do. It may seem like extra work for you to also be thinking about what they're doing and them also thinking about what you're doing, but it will improve your process going both ways.
Well, it'll save you from having to redo stuff in the future and also save you from frustration, which is like pretty frustrating. Well, frustration is frustrating.
Yeah,
it's that. Sorry, and you know what were you going to say?
No,
hopefully something
you're
that
fine.
Isn't as like straightforward as frustrating is frustrating.
No, I just wanted to say that you know, a lot of people say the best inspiration for level design is getting out and experiencing the world, and I think that mm-hmm. that applies both to our working relationships inter-studio and with our players. Is that, you know, just looking at levels and taking inspiration from levels is fine. I think, you know, if you really like a level in a game, you can emulate that. That's a great idea. But I think your best experiences come from the littlest things. You know, I designed an entire level that was a nuclear power plant. I'm certified by FEMA in radiological emergency management, as well as like management of nuclear power plants.
Wow.
So I'm fascinated by them.
Yeah. That's really cool.
But like, I've taken a lot of my education in the design of nuclear power plants and applied it to level design. And, you know, people look at architecture, people look at amusement parks. they look at city parks, pools, neighborhoods. You know, your inspiration comes from everywhere. And I think you become a better teammate when you kind of branch out and let all these worldly experiences influence your work as well. Instead of just thinking, oh, video games, video games, video games. That's great, but you also have to live your life in order to be a really good team member and a really good creator.
Yeah.
Well, because it's like you said earlier, you know, these games don't just take place in a void. Like when a player comes into a level, they're using their knowledge outside of the game and from previous games to help them get through this level. And so like having that extra experience outside of games helps you design something that is intuitive for people, even if they aren't experienced in Call of Duty or aren't experienced in other games. So that totally makes sense. A fully fleshed out life creates a better game developer.
Yep.
Preach. 100%.
I mean, it's easier said than done, though, because, you know, it's also a job. Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, you only got 24 hours, I guess.
Yeah.
So, Nina, where can our listeners find you on the internet?
So I'm on Twitter at Mrs. Chief 7. I was obsessed with Master Chief when I was a kid. So
Understandable. All right. Well, we'll share that with our listeners on the show notes page. And if you've got more questions for Nina about level design and encounter design or her cat, you will know where to find her. That's our show. For show notes and links on today's conversation, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Twitter at Nice Games Club, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and food pixels. We like hearing from you, so tweet back or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be looking at open source workflows and designing for groups. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Frustration is frustrating. I told myself at the beginning of the episode I was going to not make dumb jokes.
Well.
But I just said a dumb thing instead.